Well, could it be true? Could it be that to save wild animals, birds, and fish, we must hunt and fish for them? The thought leads us to ask, can hunting preserve wildlife?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1043rd edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way up there in Drummondville who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. But whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Struby on the boards. Jason, I have a question for you.
Fire away, sir.
Have you ever hunted for wild animals?
I have never hunted wild animals.
And why not?
Not really the hunting type.
Okay. Also with us today, we have intern producer, what's your name?
Dylan Hunsinger.
Good. I like to hear voice. Dylan, this is your first radio gig putting together a show today. And it's a very interesting, as you'll see as we go along, but got to ask you, you're an intern, you're at the University of California, a resident of California. Have you ever hunted before?
I have done what I believe hunters call taking a walk in the woods with guns. I have been hunting before, but we didn't get anything.
Okay, but you actually did go hunting at one time.
Yes, I did. My dad and I went back in 2011.
Okay, good. A father-son thing.
Yes, it was.
Okay, folks, it is a very expensive world in which we live, so things living in this world must have value. The domesticated animals we keep as pets have value. In fact, we spend about $52 billion a year keeping animals, birds, and fish, simply for our own pleasure. But what? Consider this for just a minute. What if our pets lost their value? What would happen to horses if people no longer rode them or raced them or admired them grazing in a pasture? Some very few, one supposes, might escape to the Pyre Mountains of Montana and Wyoming or to the sage-covered hills of Nevada and join up with America's last wild horses, where they would no doubt drive government bureaucrats bonkers. Or take it really close to home. What would happen to dogs, for example, if they were no longer man's best friend? Who would walk them every day? Who would pick up after them every day? Which brings us to the deer and elk that roam the land, the pheasants and quail that fly in the sky, and the fish that swim in the lakes, rivers, and oceans. What value does wildlife have? In fact, wildlife does have value. Americans spend somewhere in the neighborhood of $60 billion a year, give or take, hunting and fishing for the nation's wildlife. Given how valuable our wild animals, birds, and fish have become, we quite naturally invest a lot of effort to preserve them. But what would happen to our wildlife if we no longer wanted to hunt and fish for them? This thought leads us to ask, can hunting and fishing preserve wildlife? Well, that's a question that I assigned to intern producer Dylan Hunsinger. Dylan, have you ever considered the issue before?
I've thought about it before. I might have even talked it over with a couple of my friends. I did learn some interesting things.
What did you learn when you were putting together the show?
I learned a lot of things. I learned that hunting's played a variety of roles in conservation throughout history. Most fascinatingly, I think, is that prior to the mid-1900s and the Great Depression, we really didn't have a system of wildlife management in the U.S. And through a combination of both environmental destruction through the Industrial Revolution and unregulated hunting, when we got into the Great Depression, and then in the Great Depression you have to add in the consideration that a lot of rural families needed to put food on the table, we were seeing a lot of species of game animals that were really near extinction. So an interesting change in 1937 with the Pittman-Robertson Act, which was a hunter-backed bill that levied a tax on the sale of ammunition and other hunting equipment. And that was also the same year that Ducks Unlimited was founded. So coming out of 1937, you've got this shift where instead of hunters being part of the problem of environmental destruction and loss of animals, they were leading the charge for conservation. And that's continued through today through the efforts of organizations like Ducks Unlimited, the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, and Pheasants Forever, as well as the largely hunter-funded fish and wildlife departments across the country. And I found a great article from the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, which estimates that altogether between these private organizations and public fish and wildlife agencies, that hunters are paying over $1.6 billion per year into habitat conservation. That's a larger than any other interest group.
So what you learned then was that an interesting irony is that really the people who go out and hunt wild animals and fish and whatnot are the people who are preserving the wildlife.
Yeah, I think it's ironic, but in another way, I don't think it's really ironic at all, because you mentioned earlier in your introduction the idea of cost, and that it's very much a market system. That, yeah, if you have a vested interest in hunting and you want to go out hunting for sport and you get enjoyment out of that, you want to fund that. You have an interest in that.
There you go. Well, okay, folks, that puts our questions on the table today. Why do we manage wildlife? Why are the number of hunters diminishing? What will happen to our wildlife if we no longer hunt or fish? Well, Dylan brought to the table a couple of very interesting fellows, so we're going to put them on the line. And would like to introduce them, Dylan?
Yes, today we have Jared Wickland. He is a public relations specialist from Pheasants Forever. And also joining us today, we have Ben Lamb, who's a hunting and public lands hunting use advocate. Welcome to the food chain.
Let's start with Jared. Jared, welcome to the food chain. You there?
Hey, thanks for having me on this morning.
Good to have you aboard. What the heck is a public relations specialist doing in hunting?
Other than pushing press releases about it, not quite sure, but... You know, I do a lot of different things for public relations. I answer questions related to hunting that comes in our organization. And for listeners that might not be familiar with Pheasants Forever, Pheasants Forever and our sister organization, Quail Forever, is the nation's largest nonprofit organization dedicated to upland habitat conservation. We have 145,000 members and 700 local chapters throughout the United States, and chapters are made up of volunteers who hold fundraisers every year, and they get to determine how 100% of their locally raised funds are spent. It's the only national conservation organization that operates under that grassroots structure. And since our creation in 1982, Pheasants Forever has spent $634 million on 502,000 habitat projects, benefiting just over 14 million acres. So my job as a public relations specialist is to help tell Lori, and, I'm calling today from Minnesota. I grew up in Minnesota. Much like Dylan pointed out, I grew up with my father, got me into hunting at a very young age. And not only is it a sort of a hobby of mine to go out and spend time in nature, it's good for your health. And it also helps me provide for my family. And that's one of the reasons why I love my position as public relations specialist. And I get to tell the story of wildlife conservation and what we do on the landscape.
Well, really quickly, a real quick question here. Are pheasants native to the United States?
Pheasants are not. You know, you get, I would say there's a controversy out there sometimes about whether they're considered, we consider them an introduced species, and they're actually not a native species, an invasive species, because when you look at pheasants as a whole, they are a very colorful barometer of environmental health. When pheasants are doing well and we have a lot of pheasants on the landscape, whether it's in a particular state or across the United States as a whole, They're a very colorful barometer of environmental health, and they really don't have any negative impacts to speak of. And they are very sought after by hunters as the king of game birds here in the United States.
And furthermore, not only are they stunningly beautiful, but they're absolutely delicious.
They are delicious. Are you a pheasant hunter, Michael?
I wouldn't admit that. Of course not. But I was raised in Montana, yes. I was a pheasant hunter. I was a deer hunter. I was an elk hunter. I was a hunter. And speaking of Montana hunters, we have Ben Lamb aboard. Ben, welcome to the food chain.
Good morning. How are you?
Very good. We're going to have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to talk with, introduce you and hunting in Montana and what role hunters play in the preservation of wildlife in Montana. Specifically deer, elk, oh my goodness, everything, because everything is wild and free in Montana still. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with interim producer Dylan Hunsinger and you, 831-479-1080. Can hunting save wildlife?
Get this. You can earn a 5-6 or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-6 or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Today we're taking up the issue of hunting and giving thought to the consideration of what would happen to our wildlife if we no longer hunted and fished. If we gave it up and said this is not what we should be doing, we should be doing something else. So we all give up hunting and fishing, what would happen to our wildlife? And that's kind of the question that we're playing with today. And we have a couple very interesting guests to play with. One of them is Jared Wicklund, who's a public relations specialist for Pheasants Forever. And yes, I've hunted pheasants and I've shot them and I've eaten them and I've enjoyed it immensely. And I love hunting pheasants in the winter. Oh my goodness, what a beautiful, beautiful experience. Who else do we have, Dylan?
Well, also joining us today is Ben Lamb. Welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so Ben, I, in doing some background research, found that you used to work for the Montana Wildlife Federation. Is that correct?
Yeah, I worked for the Wildlife Federation for about 5 or 6 years.
Good. All right, and what are you up to now?
Now I'm a consultant focusing on public lands policy, wildlife policy, and do a little bit of lobby work at the state level.
Let me ask you a quick question, Ben. I assume you're a hunter.
Oh yeah.
Now, did you first go out hunting with your father?
Yeah, you know, I think like most people who grew up in the sporting lifestyle, you're introduced to it by your parents and grandparents. You know, both of my grandparents were avid outdoors people, and my father certainly, you know, my earliest memories are fishing for brook trout in beaver ponds in the Wind River Mountains of Wyoming.
Wow.
So it's the outdoor life has always been.
I tell you, just the image of that is enough to knock me over. Oh, that sounds good.
It's a tough life, you know.
Tough life, yeah. And you're up there in the big sky country of Montana, which is my home turf. And so, what do you hunt up there?
I do mostly big game, but I do upland and waterfowl as well.
Okay, good.
Avid deer hunter. I'm a really bad elk hunter, but I still get out and chase.
Well,
I'm with you, Ben.
Yes, elk are not the easiest game to bring to bear for some reason. They're pretty smart critters. But I'd like to start off with our first question of the day, which essentially is, why do we go about managing wildlife? I mean, it's wild, right? So why don't we just let it run wild? Who wants to take that first? Jared?
Yeah, I can start. You know, I think one of the things that Dylan pointed to at the beginning is that, you know, as settlers started moving west, wildlife populations really took a hit. North American wildlife populations diminished due to market hunting and habitat loss. And
what's market hunting?
Basically selling wild animals for personal profit.
Mm-hmm. Selling them to restaurants and whatnot, and people who wanted to buy the food. Okay.
Exactly, and you know, many species were actually on the brink of extinction. If you look at some of the big pheasant didn't come in. You know, their populations really didn't take a rise until about midpoint through the 1900s. But you know, in 1907, we only had 41,000 elk that remained in North America. Today, there's over 1 million, thanks to hard work and money invested by hunters. You look at white-tailed deer, which I'm a huge advocate of white-tailed deer hunting as well. There was only 500,000 whitetails that remained in 1900. Today, there's over 32 million. Turkeys, ducks is an incredible story. We have the most ducks we've ever had in history right now. Just, I think, right around 50 million ducks. So, and this all gets back to the North American wildlife conservation model. Are you guys familiar with that at all?
Well, no.
So basically, hunters like Theodore Roosevelt and rallied fellow sportsmen like myself and others on the call here, and they pushed for hunting regulations and established conservation groups to help protect habitat, the backbone of the North American wildlife conservation model. And it has a couple different principles to it that are kind of guiding. It's called the Seven Sisters for Conservation. So I'll go through this really quickly. Number one is wildlife is held in public trust. So natural resources and wildlife on public lands are managed by government agencies and available to everybody for enjoyment. You can't sell commercial hunting and sale of wildlife is prohibited. There's a democratic rule of law. Hunting and fishing laws are created through the public process, so everybody has an opportunity and responsibility to develop wildlife conservation systems. Hunting opportunity for all is number four. Every citizen has an opportunity under the law to hunt and fish in the United States and Canada. Non-frivolous use. We can't go out and kill animals just for the fun of it. There's strict guidelines for food, fur, self-defense, and property protection. And it's also an international resource. So wildlife and fish migrate freely across boundaries between states, provinces, and countries. And we work together in the United States, Canada, and other countries to make sure that we're coming up with the best practices to protect wildlife. So, you know, that was kind of the origins of conservation here in America. And it's one of the things that has brought us full circle to have one of the healthiest wildlife populations across the board in the world.
Ben, how does this all this shake out then in the relationship between hunters and government, between wildlife organizations and government?
That's a great question. You know, there are several organizations. Pheasants Forever is a great one to really kind of highlight that interplay between both state and federal governments and these nonprofit groups that work to improve habitat, improve hunter opportunity, and throughout all of it, improve wildlife habitat in general for all species, not just the species we hunt and fish for. So, you know, there's that interplay that comes in places like the Farm Bill, where a lot of wildlife funding is at play. You have the North American Wetlands Conservation Act, NACA as it's called, which helps fund a lot of the work that Ducks Unlimited does. And these federal and state programs also serve as a kind of a multiplier for private dollars that come in. And so when you see Pheasants Forever doing a project to increase pheasant propagation, you know, there's four or five different pots of money that come in. And so it's really a hand in glove type approach between the sporting community and the managers that we've hired through our license dollars and tax dollars to help help along these conservation projects.
So really a very close relationship, which is seemingly amazing, between government and hunters.
Yeah, it's and it's certainly touch and go at times. There are wildlife is never without controversy, whether we're talking about the impacts of wolves on ungulates, or we're talking about farm practices on wildlife animals. There's a lot of give and take that happens, but I think at the end of the day, as Jared has said, it's resulted in this model that has done an amazing job restoring wildlife back from the brink in the early market hunting days of the early 1900s and late 1800s.
Is this North American model emulated elsewhere in the world, Jared?
Not to my knowledge, it is not. No, and that's why they call it the North American model, and it's one of the reasons why we have great wildlife populations in this country. And just to point out a couple of different things about hunters funding conservation and working with the government. Number one, we just got done talking about NOCR, the federal duck stamp. That was a $15 stamp that all hunters in the entire United States pay, and that money comes back for wetland habitat restoration and preservation. A lot of pheasant hunters pay that. A lot of duck hunters like to pheasant hunt. A lot of pheasant hunters like to duck hunt. And, even if you're not a hunter, one of the easiest ways to give back to wildlife conservation.
Oops, don't tell anybody yet because we have to take a break. But when we come back, you can tell everybody how they can participate in the preservation of wildlife, even though they're not a hunter. And also, I want to learn about the objections to hunting as well. Do stay tuned. Now here's a question for you folks. Imagine the cow you see in the pasture out there. What if we all decided we no longer wanted to eat beef nor drink cow's milk? What would happen to cows if we just no longer decided to partake in them? Would they wander the streets as holy cows as they do in India? Probably not for long, right? So if you think about it, if we quit valuing cows, cows will sooner or later, and probably sooner, just disappear. And so I'm wondering if the same thing could happen to our wildlife. If we stop hunting and fishing, what will happen to our wildlife? Will they just disappear too? It's kind of the question we have on the table today, and we have a couple very interesting people working with us. And intern producer Dylan Hunsinger put together the show today, and he brought together Jared Wicklin, who's a public relations specialist for Pheasants Forever, and Ben Lamb, who is a hunter and wildlife and environmental advocate up there in Montana. And Jared, before we left, you were talking about ways non-hunters can participate in the preservation of wildlife and wildlife habitat. How would that be?
Correct. One of the easiest ways is the purchase of federal duck stamp. Anybody can purchase one. You don't have to be a duck hunter to purchase a federal duck stamp. You can purchase it at your post office. You can purchase it through licensed retailers all over the country. It was a $15 stamp. It went up to $25 last year. Sportsmen and women were more than happy to flip the bill because all that money comes back to conservation. So one of the easiest ways, even if you're not a hunter, to give back to conservation and wildlife populations in this country is to purchase a duck stamp. You might be a bird watcher. You might just like to hike and view animals, and that's great. And this is one way to give back to that. Another easy way, as we mentioned at the beginning of the program, is the Pittman-Robertson excise tax. There's also a tax for fishing as well, but it's basically an excise tax for hunting equipment, ammunition specifically, 11% of the wholesale price for guns and ammunition comes back in the form of dollars for states. to spend on wildlife conservation projects. It's just a wonderful thing.
You know, it sounds like from what I'm hearing today from both of you gentlemen is the basic fact that hunters and fishermen and women are among the most ardent of conservationists with respect to wildlife. But I suspect the environmental community and the animal rights community might not go along with that notion. Dylan, what did we find in that regard?
Right, and they definitely don't. And I have in front of me some objections that In Defense of Animals, the animal rights organization, has to hunting. And I want to stick with Jared for this first question, because you mentioned that a lot of people enjoy watching wildlife. And a complaint that In Defense of Animals has is that, quote, a mere 6% of the human U.S. population hunts, compared to nearly 71.8 million people who enjoy watching wildlife in 2011. Hunting is permitted on 60% of U.S. public lands, including over 50% of wildlife refuges. So I wanted to ask, is there conflict between, per se, birders and hunters, or is there actually a lot of overlap between people who are hunters and people who are also birders?
Good question. Jared, what do you think?
I think there's a lot of overlap there, especially because we've been talking about this whole time. The hunting community are the ones, mostly flipping the bill for conservation and to have the animals to go out and view in this country. I get a lot of calls about, the pheasant population specifically. You know, why are we hunting them? In some states, they're low right now. By and large, hunters take a very small proportion of total wildlife in this country, and its habitat, the effects of habitat and weather play a much larger role in managing for wildlife as far as creating populations than hunters do taking them away. So birders and everybody that just enjoys wildlife and recreation in general are benefiting from the dollars that sportsmen are putting back into the economy and into wildlife conservation efforts in this country.
Next objection.
So the next objection I'm going to direct to Ben Lamb here. A common complaint of anti-hunters is that hunting destroys families and habitat. It's very much...
What? Destroys families and habitat?
Right. They're complaining that, or pointing out that hunting can leave behind terrified baby animals whose parents have been taken by hunters. How would you address that?
Yeah, well, first of all, the habitat side of that question is simply not true. You know, I think we've well established that hunters provide billions of dollars for habitat protection that benefit, again, all species, not just the ones we hunt and fish for. But there is a little bit of truth that, you know, hunters will take an animal that has a young of the year, and those animals go through a tough time, which is why, for the most part, you know, especially species where that vulnerability truly exists, like lions and black bear, like the state of Montana has very strict rules on what animals you can take, when you can take them, and for black bear in particular, you have to be 100% certain that the animal that you harvest is has no cubs and is a mature animal. So there's a lot of thought put into the hunting community about what animal you take, the after effect of your shot. You know, the old saying is the fun stops once the animal is down, and that's very true. This is a serious thing. You know, it's something that most hunters do not take lightly, the taking of a life. And so we don't want to have orphaned cubs. We don't want to have young of the year running around. For ungulates, it's a little bit different because those animals, their life cycle is so small, they're so short that by the time hunting season runs around, say, let's take a calf elk, those calves are already weaned and feeding on their own and independent and part of the herd. And so, you know, focusing on the familial side of it, I think, really underestimates the actual biology of ungulates, because they are herd animals, you know, and there's safety in the herd. That's how these animals survived.
I guess you would call that the Bambi objection, right?
Yeah, yeah, and that's you know, you're not to blame.
it's hard to beat the Bambi objection.
Right, right, and I think that hunters have an obligation to be very ethical in their pursuit of game, and that means if you see, you know, you see a doe with a fawn, you don't necessarily need to shoot that animal. You know, there are some people who actually do prefer young of the year animals, because, you know, just like a veal, you know, a young cow,
they taste the best.
They do, you know, and
there it is. That's what it's all about, I guess, huh?
That's right. For a lot of us, it's all about, you know, high protein, sustainable.
Yeah, providing food for our family. And I was certainly raised on it myself. Folks, this is the Food Chain, Michael Olson. Hunting. Can hunting save our wildlife? We'll see if there's any more objections. And we'll go on to why hunters are disappearing. Oh, my goodness. Well, Dylan Hunsinger has another objection of the environmental community to hunting. Dylan, fire away.
Yes, I do have one more that I want to direct to Jared, because it concerns pheasants. In Defense of Animals claims that pheasants are pen-raised, as well as other game birds, to use as targets for hunters. Is that true?
And if so, so what?
It's just, you know, it depends. There are preserves out there, hunting preserves, where people are putting their own money in to raise pheasants. People use them for a lot of different things, whether it's for training their dogs at home, or whether trying to introduce a new generation of hunters in a controlled environment. You know, it's hard for a 12-year-old kid to go out and try to have success in the pheasant field when he's never done it before. So there's, you know, there are preserves that do that type of thing, but by and large, you know, if that's directed at pheasants forever, you know, pheasants forever, we work only with wild birds, and our chapters, the only thing our chapters cannot do across the country is use money, for stocked, pheasants. So we work exclusively with wildlife habitat, because we know that when we have good wildlife habitat in the landscape and good weather follows, we're going to see an increase in pheasant and quail numbers. So those are the things that we focus on is wildlife habitat.
Well, you know, it seems like we've learned a lot about hunters and conservation and whatnot. And you look at the population of the United States and how it is growing and how the population is ever expanding out into the countryside, which is sucking up all of the wildlife habitat that is not being preserved. And so I'm wondering, you know, as we become more citified and less countrified, we seem to be losing a lot of hunters. And why are we losing hunters? Dylan, do you ever come to grips with that one in your research?
a little bit. I think, speaking as a young person,
yeah,
I would say that a lot of my peers in my generation aren't necessarily anti-hunters, just very agnostic towards hunting. And I think a big part of that is that it's a tradition that's very much passed down from generation mm-hmm. to generation, and in a way you kind of have to be enculturated into it. Also taking into account the money it takes to get into hunting.
So there's lots of objections out there. Well, let me ask Ben, what do you think? Are we losing hunters, or do you see, you know, the population is still robust, Ben?
It's, you know, we've had a long, steady decline, and I think Dylan did a good job. You know, part of it is, you know, and you said this as well, the more urban the population becomes, the less connection they have to the land. You know, some states like Montana, we have a 37% participation rate, because it's Montana and we've got a lot of open land. But, you know, what a lot of hunters cite, for reasons that they hang up, the shotgun or the rifle is because of lack of access. And again, you point
where do you hunt? Yeah.
Right. You know, your traditional, pheasant spot is now a subdivision and you have to travel 3 to 4 hours to get to a hunting spot.
It's interesting because during the break, that's exactly what, Dylan was telling me. This, the place he used to live was an ideal hunting or pheasant hunting place and they had pheasant hunting clubs and now it's subdivision after subdivision and no room for pheasants. But you know, something else that was brought up earlier kind of caught my attention, and that is the role fathers play in teaching sons and daughters how to hunt. And I'm just wondering if the if that's no longer, I don't know, a lot of single mothers out there.
You know, I think to recruit new hunters, it takes hunting families, and you're absolutely right that in this country, whether it's urbanization or you know just the lack of growing up in the country anymore, when we don't have people to introduce boys and girls to the traditions of hunting and conservation, it starts to go by the wayside. And part of that is education too. And if you look at state budgets, I think Ben would probably agree with me on this. If you look at state budgets, as far as hunting and fishing dollars go and what they can put back into wildlife habitat conservation, if you look at the federal government and you look at politicians, you know, how many politicians right now we've got a presidential race coming up here or starting right now anyways. And, you know, how many of them are engaging the hunting community or how many of them have in the past? So part of that is education too. We as a hunting and conservation community need to do a better job, of showing, the public the amount of dollars we're putting into wildlife habitat conservation on an annual basis and why it is so important. You know, if people want to go out, if they're not hunters and they want to go out and view wildlife, we need to continue getting hunters involved and putting more money back into the economy for conservation.
Wow.
And there's a lot of organizations, and Pheasant Forever does this, as well as a number of other NGOs, where they pair up kids who have the desire to go with men or women who are willing to take them. And there's been a very concerted effort over the last 10 years to increase the ranks of hunters. And I think the nonprofit community and state agencies have done a remarkable job.
So still, we're faced with the fact that there are fewer and fewer hunters, which leads me to the thought of what will happen to our wildlife. Should we just no longer hunt? So should we give it up and become totally citified people who no longer enjoy going out into the wilderness to hunt wild animals? What will then happen to our wild animals? And that's the question we're going to put to Ben and Jared when we get back. Do stay tuned.
Wow, MetroFarm.com says we can earn a 5, 6, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
And we don't even have to own the land. We can lease it year to year.
MetroFarm.com says we can grow fruit on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, vegetables in city greenbelts, and ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
We can even grow flowers on our wooded hillside.
Get all the information you need to grow for profit at MetroFarm.com, including the complete guide to earning 5, 6, and 7-figure incomes by farming small parcels of land. Meet the farmers who earn the money. Find experts at MetroFarm.com who will examine your property and assess which crops to grow. Meet consultants who will help steer your project to profitability. And get the latest news about the business of growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
We've always dreamed about farming a small parcel of land. At MetroFarm.com, we can get all the help we need to stop dreaming and start growing.
They say we spend $25 billion a year sweating it out at the gym. Sweat contains some of the essential nutrients your body needs to grow strong and stay healthy. If you sweat these nutrients out and fail to replace them, your body will begin breaking down. Some say you can get all 90 of the essential nutrients from the foods you eat. Maybe. But if you eat foods from farmed out soils or foods that have had the life processed out of them, you will deprive your body of some essential nutrients. You can get all 90 of the essential nutrients your body needs for less than a daily latte with a 90 for Life Healthy Start Pack. It's easy, it's delicious, and they are essential.
Get all 90 of the essential nutrients your body needs to grow strong and stay healthy with a 90 for Life Healthy Start Pack at NutrientsToGo.com. That's NutrientsToGo.com. Get all 90 of the essential nutrients your body needs for less than the cost of a daily latte at NutrientsToGo.com. That's NutrientsToGo.com.
Well, folks, we're right down to the question of the day, which is, what on earth will happen to our wildlife if we no longer hunt and fish for that wildlife? What if we give up hunting and fishing? To heck with it. If there's something else to do, and video games. We'll play video games all day long. And that's that, and to heck with hunting. What on earth will happen to our wildlife? Who will maintain the wildlife habitat when we no longer care about the wildlife, or we no longer value the wildlife in that habitat? Who will protect that wildlife habitat? Will it become subjugated by the city? More likely. Let's ask our guests. Let's start with Jared Wicklund. You with pheasants forever, pheasants and quail forever. What do you think would happen, just pure speculation, if everybody gave up hunting and no longer valued wildlife as a resource like that?
You know, it would be a pretty bleak future for wildlife in this country if hunters put down their weapons, stop buying gear, stop buying licenses. You know, one thing I want to point out is that barely more than 1% of our federal budget goes to conservation programs. Yet conservation programs support tourism and an outdoor recreation industry in this country that pumps hundreds of billions of dollars into the U.S. economy every single year. And I think there's an important distinction here to make, too, is that this funding that we're talking about that comes from Hunters for Wildlife, it's not just for huntable wildlife, but for all wildlife. You know, the things that Pheasants Forever is doing, I noticed you talked about bees on a show not too long ago. Pollinator habitat is a very important aspect for us. You know, everybody's heard about the collapse of honeybees and monarch butterflies. The things that sportsmen are doing in this country, and they're flipping the bill for conservation, and it's not just for huntable wildlife. It's all wildlife, and it's paid for by sportsmen. So it could be a very bleak future if hunters and fishermen were not here to support those efforts.
Ben Lamb, what do you think?
I think Jared's absolutely right. You know, if you want to envision a world where there are no hunters and anglers, I think you have to look at some countries where hunters and anglers aren't there to stand up and support wildlife, and that that becomes very quickly a country that does not have the kind of diversity and you know, wonderful outdoor opportunities that we have. You know, there, you know, the funding side of this is super important, and I think if you lose hunters and anglers, not only do you lose the dollars that go with that, you also lose some of the most ardent defenders of wildlife conservation in the world, and that would I think that would just spell disaster for wildlife and especially wildlife habitat.
And that's kind of what I was thinking, you know, that habitat is still valuable if we don't value the wildlife. And so it becomes extremely attractive to development. I mean, why hold something aside if we're not going to use the resource within it? We can use it for something else. And I guess that's my great fear of losing our hunting and fishing and the joy with which we take in those endeavors and with respect and the conservation which we hold our wildlife. Folks, been the Food Chain Radio program produced this time by intern producer Dylan Hunsinger. Thank you very much, Dylan. Jared Wicklin with us, public relations specialist, Pheasants Forever. Ben Lamb, hunting advocate from my home country, the Big Sky Country of Montana. And we'll see you all next week for another edition of Food Chain. Remember Michael Olson's second law of the food chain. The farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have over what's in that food. Thank you all for tuning in.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.